little confusing. You have the Johns of the New Testament, John the Baptist, the Apostle John. I think there are a couple other Johns in there if you look hard enough. And then you've got the Johns of the Church Fathers, and there are a lot of them as well. We're going to look at one of these Johns, St. John of Damascus, 8th century hymn writer, church father, theologian. Here in the first half hour of Issues, Etc., I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Pastor Will Wheaton will be our guest here in just a moment for the first half hour. And then in the second half hour, we've got some audio open lines for your questions and your comments. Very interesting speech that is being previewed by Mitt Romney's crowd. Mitt Romney, of course, is the Mormon running for president on the Republican ticket. And one of the questions that has been plaguing him is, tell us about your religion. What role does it play in the way you would govern from the White House? What is it going to mean to have a Mormon president? Well, I guess Thursday. Mitt Romney plans on answering some of those questions. We're going to play a little analysis from National Public Radio, speculating as to what he might say, what he might need to say, what he shouldn't say, and then I want to hear from you in the second half hour. What does Mitt Romney need to say, as far as you're concerned, to clear up the questions about being a Mormon and running for president? Then after that, in the second hour of the program, Pastor Stephen Parks will be our guest. It is often said that when Jesus says, "This is my body," when he gives the Lord's Supper, "This is my blood," he's speaking figuratively, as he does when he says, "I am the door," or, "I am the vine, you are the branches," John 15:1. Do those passages help explain away what Jesus seems to be saying in the Lord's Supper? We'll answer that question with Pastor Stephen Parks in our ongoing conversation on evangelical proof texts. Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute will join us at 3:30 for a brief conversation responding to, well, she's really hitting on all cylinders, but she is apparently not decided whether she thinks this is good news or bad news. The breakthrough that they had with stem cells a couple of weeks ago has Ellen Goodman writing all over the country in her column. She says no one should be taking credit for it, and she seems to be, well, she says it's good news, seems to be rather unhappy about it for some reason. We'll see what Wesley has to say in response to Ellen Goodman there. At 4:45, we begin a conversation that'll run through the end of the program. Dr. John West has written a new book titled Darwin Day in America, How Our Politics and Culture Have Been Dehumanized in the Name of Science. That pretty much covers the subject we'll be discussing there in the last 45 minutes of Issues, Etc. Our call-in number is this Tuesday, December the 4th, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, as usual, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Pastor Will Wheaton is a regular guest. He's pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Pastor Wheaton, welcome back.
Thank you, and thank you for preaching for me the other week.
Well, I was going to thank you for allowing me to come and have the privilege of being with your people a couple Sundays ago.
They really enjoyed it.
Well, I like, you know what I like about going to St. Paul and Hamel? Somehow you manage to, when the first service lets out, and in most churches people head for the door, and I mean the back door, to go home, somehow you manage to keep almost 100 of them around between the services for Bible class. It's very nice to be able to teach a Bible class with so many attentive ears.
Yeah, that's a great Bible class. They always amaze me.
Well, St. John of Damascus is sometimes called the last of the fathers, yet that's only the 8th century. Do you think that's a fitting title for him?
Yeah, he brackets. He's kind of like a pivotal figure. I think if you read his great work on the Orthodox faith, or the exposition of the Orthodox faith, you can see how he's got a lot of the patristic wisdom is still alive and perking inside of him. And you can also see a move towards what would become the way that theology develops throughout the Middle Ages. You can also see forerunners of that happening in him as he writes. He's like a pivotal figure that way. I definitely think he's the last of the great fathers for quite a while.
What was happening in the 8th century in the church, these events, these times, and the ideas that were floating around, of which St. John of Damascus was so much a part?
In the 8th century, the big story was the rise of Islam. It sounds like today. John actually never lived outside of the influence of a Muslim-dominated government. And that actually, in his case, turned out to be good news. Because at the head of the Byzantine Empire, the emperor during the days of John of Damascus instituted a real persecution in the church against those who taught that it was okay to have depictions of Christ and the saints adorned the walls of the church. That where you have that, the emperor said, you know, that's got to stop. Well, John, safely under the, you know, under another government, speaks up and says, absolutely not. That's not a problem at all. And he bases his arguments for this hugely on the incarnation. He goes, yeah, it's absolutely true that God said in the Old Testament, you not only shall you not, but you cannot make a graven image of me. God is spirit, you know, and you can't picture spirit. It can't happen. But when the eternal Son of God became flesh, born of the Virgin Mary, something changed. And what changed was now you can draw a picture of a man who is truly God. And so the church, very gradually at first, but it did definitely spread and was accepted throughout the entire church, this idea that you could indeed depict God. And that was viewed as a very important confession of the incarnation. He was protected there from the persecution that was sweeping the rest of the empire. You know, he was under Muslim rule. They couldn't get at him, and he was able then to write freely and to speak about this to a great extent.
It's really hard, I think, for us from this vantage point to understand that controversy in the Christian church there in the 8th century, given the fact that even those elements of the church today that eschew images like crucifixes, they still have seen Jesus depicted in great works of art. And many, many churches still have statuary, still have stained glass, still have paintings. And I know your church has a picture of the risen Christ blessing the congregation, actually a statue there above the altar.
Yeah, we have a statue, and we have two paintings as well inside of the sanctuary. And nobody looks at that and thinks of it as odd. But, I mean, but let's step back for a second and think about the world in which the church was first born, a place where people honestly did worship images, okay? It came home to me. I think I told this story on KFUO before, but I'll tell it again. It came home to me when I had a visitor stop at our church, and it was a Hindu. And he said, I want to see inside your church. I pass this all the time, and I just would like to see inside. So I let him in. And I will never forget my horror as he stops and gasps and says, oh, a temple with a proper idol. I was like, no! how do you explain? I mean, there's no Christian in the world that's in danger of identifying Jesus Christ with a statue. You know what I mean? Our Lord is a living Lord, and we know that. We know that the statues, the paintings, whatever they are, they're there as they're charismatic in function. They proclaim to us truths about our Lord, the one above our altar. It's the risen or the ascending Christ.